Religion for the Morning on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And stay tuned for some politics, local, state, national, international, around issues of civil rights for the poor with Bathroom Spear's Broadsides. I'm your host, Bathroom Spear Robert Morris. I'll be with you until 1:30 today here on 96.3. You can join us if you want to call in at 423-5361. Stay tuned. Lots of good stuff.
Batman, John Brando, the king and I, and the catcher in the rye. Eisenhower vaccine, England's got a new queen. Cassiano, Liberace, Sapphire,
Fire.
You're tuned to, again, Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. This is a twice-weekly show concerned with civil rights in Santa Cruz, both for poor people and folks who aren't as poor as they could be, but who still live in a society that seems to have a police force that's somewhat out of control and wants to put it back in control, and a whole set of laws that seems designed to give police more and more power. One whole area of that, of course, is the drug prohibition war. That is the war to keep revenues coming in for the police department and the prosecutors with this incredible marijuana prohibition that's been going on for 50 years, and which California has taken a giant step forward in trying to end, at least medicinally, for folks who use medical marijuana. And they're, of course, being fought at every turn. We're going to have some interviews on that subject today with attorney Kate Wells, who's attorney for the local Cannabis Buyers Club or Cannabis Users Club. I'm not quite sure what they're calling themselves. Or actually, they have closed down. They closed down 2 weeks ago, hoping to reopen again. But they are feeling the bite and the chill of the wind coming from Washington and coming from Sacramento. that will attempt to overturn the will of the voters and criminalize literally millions of people. I have an interesting article here from High Times, recreational marijuana and I guess also concerned with medicinal marijuana. The May issue talks about the DEA forced to consider down-scheduling marijuana. Interesting article. I'm going to read it to you to kind of begin the show. Marijuana is a subject, of course, that concerns folks across the board economically, but more particularly if you're poor, in the sense that you're on the front lines of the drug prohibition war, because that's one of the major excuses that police use to jack up poor people. And it's also one of the few means that poor people have in the underground economy of making money in a situation where jobs are scarce and hard to find as they flee to other countries and as the economy turns into a sort of a huge service economy. So marijuana is a real political and class issue as far as I'm concerned. And let's see what the High Witness News has to say about it. That's from High Times, again, May 1998. This is by the High Witness News team. In Washington, marijuana has been improperly classified in law for nearly 30 years as a powerfully addictive drug devoid of any accepted medical uses, the Drug Enforcement Administration's quietly conceded last December. In a series of brief communications to Virginia public policy expert John Getman and attorneys for High Times in New York, the DEA confirmed that current scientific evidence presented to it in 1995 in a 270-page petition filed by John Getman has obliged the Justice Department to request binding guidance from the Department of Health and Human Services in seeking a more appropriate regulatory category for pot on the federal controlled substances list. After the Controlled Substances Act was passed in Congress in 1970, Getman points out in his petition, marijuana was placed in Schedule 1, the law's most restrictive classification, by administrators who were confident that researchers would prove it to be mightily addictive. Tracing the Act's legislative history, Getman demonstrates that, in fact, Congress clearly intended marijuana's Schedule 1 status to be contingent on such scientific findings, which have never materialized. To the contrary, the commission appointed by then-President Richard Nixon to evaluate research into marijuana's abuse potential under Pennsylvania Governor Raymond Schaefer wound up recommending its decriminalization. Getman's petition, incorporating over 170 journal reports and government findings, painstakingly traces the work of every authoritative research panel since then by bodies as disparate as the National Institutes of Health and the DEA itself. None has succeeded in demonstrating any gravely significant abuse potential for marijuana, and all have uniformly concurred that its placement in Schedule 1 is inappropriate. Getman himself, who has served for over a decade as High Times' foremost contributor of articles on cannabis public policy and marijuana science, was a party to the historic Normal versus DEA lawsuit, which wound up with a 1989 determination by the DEA's own administrative law judge, the late Honorable Francis Young, that pot's addictive properties are so negligible and its medical uses so extensive and solidly demonstrated that its Schedule 1 assignment is not only arbitrary but capricious. Getman at the time was national director of Normal and was stunned when the DEA simply overrode Judge Young's determination and kept pot in Schedule 1, the category ordaining the stiffest prison sentences and most intensive police controls, and barring not only any medical use, but virtually all research on medical use. So when Getman began compiling a new rescheduling petition, he went about it differently. By corresponding formally with the DEA through the office of his senator, the highly conservative John Warner, Republican of Virginia, Getman, now a graduate student in public policy at George Mason University in Fairfax, obtained in 1995 a clear statement from DEA Acting Administrator Thomas Constantine that he was unaware of any new scientific evidence that might oblige the DEA to consider rescheduling pot. And then Getman promptly proceeded to apprise them of such evidence. In this petition, invoking the CSA's own rulemaking provisions. Under these provisions, Getman maintains, and the DEA has now agreed, if Health and Human Services reviews this material and determines that marijuana should be placed in a less restrictive schedule, the DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, will be unable to override that determination, as they did Judge Young's before. The new evidence Getman puts forth was probably not entirely unknown to DEA Drug Evaluation Chief Frank Spienza, whose job involves keeping abreast of pharmacological science. Briefly, scientists in the 1980s determined that marijuana's cannabinoids, like THC and CBD, operate on nerve cells with discrete receptor sites tailored to accommodate molecules which chemically resemble them. This finding comprehensively invalidated a basic misunderstanding on which generations of pseudoscientific reefer madness claims had been based. Called the cell perturbation theory, this invalid paradigm was essential to all the political horror stories of physical disruption and steel trap addiction spouted by anti-pot propagandists. While the elucidation of cannabinoid receptor site mechanisms helps account for pot's extremely low physical toxicity, Getman explains, it's the mapping of these cannabinoid-friendly nerve sites in the central nervous system which helps account for its negligible addiction liability. Cannabinoid receptors do not operate directly on brain cells transmitting dopamine, the nerve hormone most powerfully involved with addiction, nor are they located in the regions of the central nervous system most perturbed by the long-term administration of addictive drugs like heroin or cocaine. Best of all, as Getman demonstrates, the current understanding of how cannabinoids operate in the brain can be used, and here he cites work by researchers like Dr. George Kube of the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla, California, who could certainly never be accused of being soft on pot, to ultimately determine precisely how much less addictive pot is than nicotine, alcohol, caffeine, cocaine, and other drugs, which, unlike pot, can be shown to be addictive in animals as well as humans. While all this research was presumably known to DEA's monitors, it was never forcibly presented to them before Getman's petition, which came to them backed up by three brilliant essays he'd composed for High Times: Marijuana on the Brain, March 95, Part 2, The Tolerance Factor, July 95, and Drug Abuse, Cannabis on the Brain. It was a matter of forcing them to acknowledge that they knew perfectly well about all this exculpatory pot research, says a source close to the rescheduling process. Now, the CSA itself says they will have to abide by whatever the FDA recommends. The FDA, Federal Drug Administration, as the Health and Human Services agency involved in this process, could still recommend that pot stay on Schedule 1 or 2, but Getman promises in that event they'll face another lawsuit for arbitrary and capricious rulemaking. Also, it's widely known in pharmaceutical circles that the FDA is under pressure from numerous drug companies to reschedule cannabis derivatives so doctors can prescribe them and the drug industry reap the profits. Cannabinoid derivatives are already in hospital use in Israel, and last winter, just as the DEA agreed to submit to this rulemaking change, in fact, a drug company in North Carolina, Atlantic Pharmaceuticals, began wooing investors with claims for its new anti-arthritis compound CT3, a slightly modified version of the 11-hydroxy-THC molecule. The race, it seems, is already on, thanks to John Getman. Now, if you were able to understand any of that article, what it really is saying is that this time the federal government will not be able to simply dump in the trash can judicial findings that marijuana is not addictive. And this is a very significant development covered in High Times, May of 1998. If you're interested in more details about this, of course, you can call Huff, 423-HUFF. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. It's a civil rights organization concerned with, and there's our phone, civil rights for the homeless and other issues as well. Let's see if we can get the community in on this issue.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Becca home?
No. Now this is, you've reached a live line.
I thought it was her show today.
No. Well, she comes on at 1:30. That's Reckless.
Reckless at 1:30.
Yeah, so tune in then.
Or you can tune in now and talk to me. I'm on the air. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor. Of course, while it looks like we are gaining some ground in the scientific arena, in San Francisco, there's lots of juggling going around as the federal government tries to thwart the will of the voters in the state who have passed Proposition 215, and they're going after the cannabis club there.
also, of course, in San Jose as well. But here's an interesting article in the Chronicle from Friday by Glenn Martin, operator to close San Francisco Cannabis Club. Leave it to Dennis Perrone to figure out a way to wiggle around a San Francisco judge's order to shut down the Cannabis Cultivation Club. Yesterday, Perrone announced that the organization was going out of business. He also announced it would instantly reopen with a new name, new rules, and a 78-year-old woman as its new director. Perrone said he would have no ties to the new group. I'm out of it completely, he said. He also said he had requested that the sheriff's department close his club. It will probably happen early next week, he said. We've asked them to respect our campaign offices because I'm running for governor in the Republican primary against Dan Lundgren. Otherwise, they will be able to seize any property they find and seal the building. The keys will then be handed over to the landlord. Perrone said his landlord has agreed to lease the building immediately to Hazel Rogers, a 78-year-old artist and member of the Cultivators Club who suffers from glaucoma and other maladies. She has agreed to be director of the new club, which will be called the Cannabis Healing Center, Perrone said. If the state attorney general's office wants to deal in technicalities, we can play the same game. Wednesday's order by Superior Court Judge David Garcia declared that Perrone was illegally selling marijuana at the club and that either the San Francisco Sheriff's Department or the California Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement could shut it down. Garcia said that only primary caregivers can provide marijuana to patients under provisions of Proposition 215, the state medical marijuana initiative that passed last year, not businesses that purveyed the weed. John Entwistle, a spokesman for the Cannabis Cultivators Club, said Perrone's move will nullify Garcia's order. Rogers will not distribute to caregivers, said Entwistle. She'll only provide marijuana directly to the patients. That conforms in every way to the exact language of Proposition 215. Rogers said she wasn't sure of all the ramifications of her new position, but she was looking forward to it. I'm honored, she said. There'll probably be 100 people to help me run it. It will be fun to sit in Dennis's chair and put my feet up on his desk. One thing's for sure, we're going to obey the letter of the law. By requesting the San Francisco Sheriff's Department to close the club, Perrone is enlisting the aid of an old ally. I have total confidence in Sheriff Michael Hennessy, Perrone said. He's an honest man, and I trust him to carry out Garcia's order in a fair and lawful fashion. Lillian Brown, a spokeswoman for the sheriff's office, said Hennessy has decided that he will probably go ahead with the eviction, though he hasn't decided when. He will decide that with his staff. Perrone said he wanted to make sure that state narcotics agents did not have the opportunity to close the club. There has been bad blood between Perrone and California Attorney General Dan Lundgren since 1996 when state agents raided the club. Perrone still faces criminal charges of illegally selling marijuana as a result of that raid. I just don't want those state narcotics agents in here wearing their rubber gloves, standing around making jokes about AIDS to sick people, Perrone said. Matt Ross, a spokesman for Lundgren, said he could not comment on the prospect of the Cultivators Club closing until we see what Perrone is up to. Perrone said he will probably open a new medical marijuana club in time, but not at his old Market Street address. I'm too busy running for governor right now anyway, he said. And that, of course, is something folks should consider, that the primary is coming up. And it's an open primary, so anyone who wants to can vote for Dennis Perrone in the Republican primary. Certainly a much better candidate than Dan Lundgren, no question about it. The story I just read was from the San Francisco Chronicle on Friday, April 17th. It's in the library if you want to read it. And it shows that folks are not going to be crushed, downhearted, or turned away from their basic task of providing medical marijuana to people who need it, and allowing for that to happen. And I hope that that happens here in Santa Cruz as well, where we've been having economic problems with the local cannabis club. And I understand WAM, the other organization in town concerned with making sure that folks who need marijuana get it, is also being targeted by a group no less than our very own Santa Cruz Police Department. What I've heard is that the Santa Cruz Police Department has specifically sent in ringers into the club with the names and numbers of doctors and doctors' prescriptions, but the numbers aren't, the names of the doctors are real, the prescriptions look real, but the phone numbers lead directly to, the phone numbers lead directly to police officers. And that apparently is what Valerie Corral found out when she checked out some of these prescriptions earlier this last week. Outrageous behavior and a clear violation of the understanding that City Council has with the cannabis clubs, that it is in fact supporting the right of sick people to use medical marijuana. This is a direct police department attack on the rights of the poor, the rights of the ill, the rights of people who are in need of medical marijuana and are doing all they can to exist within the law. I mean, for God's sake, first the county passed the law recommending that medical marijuana be made legal. Then the state, through painstaking initiative in 1996, did the same. And now you have these robocops from the federal government, from the state offices of Dan Lundgren, and now apparently from Chief Belcher's own police department, moving in to harass medical marijuana patients. It's incredible. It's outrageous. If anybody has any thoughts about it, our lines are open here at 423-5361. If you want to call in, if you have any reflections on this, or if you yourself have suffered from some kind of problem with the local police department that is along these lines. I think it's important that the community know just what's going on here. This kind of ongoing struggle by the community is happening in other areas as well. It's happening up in Mendocino County. The Anderson Valley Advertiser had a very good article on the subject, which I'm going to read as soon as I catch this next caller. Caller, don't give up. Try calling me again. Our lines are open. We're interested in what you have to say out there. This is an article by Mark Hyman. County courts are illegally keeping the records of your old pot busts. Attention, pot smokers. If you or someone you know has been arrested or convicted of misdemeanor possession of marijuana in any amount or arrested for transporting less than 28.5 grams of marijuana since January 1st, 1976, you most likely are being screwed by the Mendocino County Courts, and it could also be by the Santa Cruz County Courts, the DA's office, and the arresting police agency. I don't mean you were screwed for getting caught and convicted. We all know you were guilty of sin for getting caught partaking of the devil weed. I mean you're still getting screwed by the forces of law and order, who are ignorant of the very laws they're sworn to uphold. If your misdemeanor pot conviction is more than 2 years old and you have completed probation, paid the fines, and complied with any and all court orders pertaining to the conviction by law, the records of that arrest and conviction are supposed to be physically destroyed, and you can truthfully say by law that it never happened. All public agencies that keep these records are legally bound to automatically destroy misdemeanor pot conviction and arrest records after 2 years. But guess what? No one at the Mendocino County Courthouse was aware of the law. Health and Safety Code Section 1136.1.5, again, 1136.1.5, until I pointed it out to them last week, or several weeks ago. Currently, all misdemeanor records are kept for at least 10 years until court staff can get around to purging the files to make room for more up-to-date records. But what has, in fact, been happening? Old pot records are simply carted off to the courthouse basement where they stay indefinitely, awaiting the day some enterprising law officer dusts them off to use against you in a variety of ways. This is an article by Mark Hyman about Mendocino County, but I would wonder if, in fact, we don't have a similar problem here in Santa Cruz. Perhaps a researcher who's interested, who's listening to this broadcast, can take on this issue. The Sheriff's Department, the Narcotics Task Force, ComMet, municipal police agencies, the DA's office, and probation are all agencies that keep some form of the same records, and all are just as ignorant of the law as the courthouse staff. This is up in Mendocino. The California Department of Justice and the DMV can also be a repository of these records and are also bound by Health and Services Code Section 11361.5. But for the purpose of this report, only county agencies were contacted. I took up the matter with the presiding judge of the Mendocino Coordinated Courts, Judge Eric Labowitz, who was just as surprised as the court clerks to learn that they had been in violation of the law since 1975, when the law was first enacted. And this is a state law, so even though we're talking about Mendocino County, it should be equally applicable here in Santa Cruz. Judge Labowitz commented, "I guess the court staff is going to be pretty busy for a while going through all the records to weed out cases that should have been tossed years ago." Labowitz said he would call Sonoma and Humboldt County officials to see if they know of the law and how they are complying with it. Judge Labowitz's good intentions aside, experience tells me it's going to take pressure from citizens to bring Mendo County officials into compliance. It's not just the courts who face the daunting task of going through over 20 years' worth of records, but the DA's office and the arresting police agencies. Neither the Sheriff's Department nor the DA's office was aware of the law, and both still maintain records of misdemeanor or pot busts a decade old. It's going to take a real commitment of manpower and resources to physically destroy all the records that are subject to Health and Safety Code Section 11361.5. A commitment lame duck department heads like Sheriff Tusso and D.A. Massini, not to mention our own D.A. and our own Sheriff Mark Tracy, will, we can be sure, resist. Massini and Tusso are always quick with the "I don't make the laws, I only enforce them" dodge when confronted with their fanatical pursuit of pot users, even people who have a legitimate and legal need for pot's healing properties under Proposition 215, voted into law by the people of California. This isn't just an administrative problem. The keeping of records of misdemeanor marijuana convictions and arrests past the statutory two-year limit can have real-world consequences for victims of the government's failed war on drugs. For example, a job applicant who doesn't list a misdemeanor pot bust can be denied work or fired if the employer checks the records and finds it. But if the law is being complied with, the prospective employee after 2 years can legally treat the incident as if it never happened, which was the intent of the law in the first place. Security clearances, bonds, professional licenses, and alcohol and beverage control permits can also be affected. Just such a thing happened a few years ago when Sheriff Jim Tusso, that's up in Mendocino County, used a Bush League marijuana conviction of an Anderson Valley woman as the reason to deny her a beer and wine permit for a popular local restaurant. As a result of the permit denial, the struggling business folded. If our public agencies had complied with the Section 11361.5 and destroyed the records after 2 years, like they were supposed to do, Sheriff Tusso could not have used the woman's petty record to demagogue the pot issue and wreck her business. But perhaps the most insidious consequence of public agencies not obeying the law falls on the head of a group of people already targeted by the government as of being unworthy of the protections of the U.S. Constitution than the rest of us, by law, are afforded. Immigrants, both legal and not legal. The Immigration and Naturalization Service can use a past pot conviction or even an arrest for pot possession without a conviction to deport an otherwise legal immigrant out of the country. And the INS can do this without a trial, only an administrative hearing conducted by an INS employee, and without telling the immigrant's lawyer what the charges or evidence against the immigrant are. The INS can use the county's records that the county was required by law to destroy and didn't, to deport persons they don't like, and keep the whole thing secret, even from the deportee, him or herself. Illegally maintained county records can also be used by the probation department as a consideration as to the recommendation probation will make to the court during the sentencing phase of a trial. And ancient busts are routinely used by probation in just this way. Clearly, if the county's law enforcement establishment is to scrupulously operate within, inside the law themselves, they too must be bound by the law. If 2 years have passed since you've been convicted for a misdemeanor marijuana offense or arrested for a pot violation without a conviction, immediately contact the Superior Court Clerk, the DA's office, and the arresting police agency and ask to see the records of your arrest and conviction. Unless they tell you your records have already been physically destroyed, demand they immediately do so in compliance with Health and Safety Code Section 11361.5. Copies of the code section can be obtained at the Mendocino County Law Library and, of course, can also be obtained at the Santa Cruz County Library, Law Library, which is in the basement of the county building at 701 Ocean Street. Read the law carefully, keeping in mind that, as they say, some restrictions may apply. Then contact your lawyer and point out that the opinion found in Section 48.20 of the Criminal Law Procedure and Practice states, quote, records subject to destruction under 11361.5 are not considered accurate after they should have been destroyed. The records may not be accurate or even legal, but they can still hurt you. This is a story in the April 8th edition of the Anderson Valley Advertiser, which is a weekly paper, a lot of good articles, which you can pick up at the Book Loft. The Book Loft is a bookstore right next to the Rio Theater at Soquel and Seabright. And I give them a particular plug rather than the bigger anti-homeless downtown bookshop, the Bookshop Santa Cruz, which also has it, because I think you should buy from stores that don't harass homeless people. And I'm afraid that the Bookshop Santa Cruz is unfortunately one of the stores downtown, part of the downtown association that gave us the downtown ordinances, which make it illegal to sit down 10 feet from a store. We got an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, this is Donna from the tennis venue.
Oh, hi, Donna.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good. Have you been listening to our show?
Yes.
Oh, good. And are you commenting on what you've heard on the show, or are you commenting on something from the tenants' union?
Yes, I'm commenting on what you were talking about in regards to medical marijuana and the police here in Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to let you know that I know you're aware that last year, in July, the police came out because somebody said I had a plant on my porch, and I had to go through this whole thing, and they tried to give me a 30-day notice, and they rescinded it and all that. Well, a week ago, I and Billy were coming back to my apartment where I've lived for 4 years and come and go regularly. Most people here know me really well. And Marco wasn't here. I didn't have the key, so I pushed Billy through my own window, and all of a sudden there were four cops at my door, and they wouldn't let me come back inside my apartment without one of them, and the one that came in with me was very belligerent.
These were Santa Cruz police officers?
Yes. And he had blonde hair parted on the side, and was, you know.
But you didn't catch his name?
No, I didn't. But the other cops thought he was kind of a bully, too, because they're saying, oh, I'm not against marijuana, you know, to Billy outside. I think medical marijuana is okay, but this one guy was, like, being really pushy with me. I really had to stand up to him and show him my letter from my doctor to get him out of here, and he still wanted to know what the diagnosis was. I tried to tell him he didn't have a right to know that, but I did manage to get him out of here, which was good. But I'd like to know what's going on with our medical marijuana people, why they're being harassed by the police in their own homes this way.
I think you have a... You're raising a really important question, and I'm hoping that other folks listening to this call will support you. Perhaps you can raise the issue publicly. You're doing so, of course, now on the radio, but I think it would be good to raise the issue to the police department through a complaint to the Citizens Police Review Toy Poodle Board, which, I think, not because they'll do anything, but because I think it's useful to keep a record. I think you should contact the mayor. You should call Celia Scott and tell her what you think exactly what happened. I think you should specifically file a complaint against this particular officer, and you don't have to know his name. All you have to know is the date of the incident and when and where it happened.
Right.
And just call the, tell the police chief you want to, call the police department directly and say, I would like to file a complaint. I want this man's name so I can properly file it. And call up also SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now. That's a group that has been operating independently for about a decade. Nick Whitehead of SPAN does a real, real good job, although he really needs a lot of help. And for anybody out there who is interested in helping, they can also take note of this number. The number is 475-2012, 475-2012. That's SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now. The Police Review Board number, and you can actually call as soon as you hang up, Donna, even though it's a Sunday, you can just leave them a message and have them call you back. So you don't have to, keep waiting and hoping to make the right call at the right time. Their phone number is 429-3262. That's the Citizens Police Review Board, which has been getting a lot of caricaturing in the paper. If you look at today's Sunday Sentinel, you'll see the Citizens Police Review Board is being portrayed as a bunch of nitwits, or possibly it's the people talking to the Citizens Police Review Board. The same thing happened in the Metro last week. Did you check those cartoons out? Still there?
Oh, I haven't had a chance to yet.
Yeah, well, I just thought I'd mention it because it's really kind of ironic, because the Citizens Police Review Board is really the best friend the police department has. The police department almost never gets criticized by the CPRB, and if you send in a complaint to the CPRB, almost always, not always, but almost always, their dispositions are invariably the same as the disposition of the internal affairs of the police department, which is understandable because the Police Review Board doesn't investigate anything. All it does is it's kind of the the out file, the last step before the complaints go to the police department. They investigate them, and then they pass on those complaints and the investigation reports to the police review board, which behind closed doors looks at those reports. Still, it's useful, I think, for you to call up and complain about this officer, because it's also useful for you to demand a public hearing. You should say, I demand a public hearing for this officer. I think it's a matter of public interest when people's houses are invaded around this medical marijuana issue. I think the police officer should have to account for his behavior publicly. And I think that you might even get them to hold their first ever public hearing. You know, that would be quite a coup, quite a feather in your cap. So there, I've rambled on enough. Any thoughts about any of that?
Well, they weren't at Earth Day yesterday, were they?
What, the Citizens Police Review Board?
Right.
I saw one of the members of the Citizens Police Review Board, Alan Lang. Unfortunately, and I'll say this publicly, seems to be getting kind of, dare I say, senile, forgetful. He's missed meetings repeatedly, but he also is the only member who at the last board meeting, for the first time that I ever heard of, actually called for an independent investigation of the Button Street shooting, the alleged misconduct by four officers who broke into Lori and Brian Andrus's house, jacked up Lori Andrus, and then shot Brian Andrus four times when, at least from his account or from her account, he was attempting to defend, from the neighbor's account, and tried attempting to defend Lori Andrus with a baseball bat. Apparently, pepper spray, batons, and four grown men are not enough. They got to use their guns and shoot 8 to 10 bullets in a neighborhood filled with kids, with two bullets going into the nursery of the Andrus infant. And who knows? Anyway, the police review board didn't seem terribly concerned about it last time, although they are suggesting that all shooting incidents be looked at. But of course, what they mean by that is that all the reports go through them in behind closed doors sessions without any independent investigation or public hearings, which of course is useless anyway. But you're also with the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz, right?
Yes.
Do you have any update for us on that?
Well, I thought yesterday was pretty great, meeting a lot of people from the community you might not ordinarily meet on the mall. Or
this was on downtown. Earth Day?
Yes. People came from the mountains and Aptos and even out of the county, so I thought that was a good opportunity to get different people's opinions and let them know what we're doing. And
big shindig out on the
with all the other groups. And
San Lorenzo Benchlands, I guess you were there all afternoon with your Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz table.
And I hope we're going to have like a event with a couple of these bands to donate their energy to help us raise some money and get everybody involved in another activity real soon.
So is there anything specific coming up that folks should know about?
I'm going to give you to Marco, okay?
Sure.
Hi, Robert. And everybody out there.
And who are we talking to here?
Excuse me?
Who is this?
This is Marco Marocchi.
Marco Marocchi.
Tenants' Rights Union.
Ah, yes. And
we are the people who are true to you.
Indeed. So what is going on with this Tenants' Rights Union? Are you... Are you going to court these days with tenants, or what's happening?
We go to court. We encourage people to appear in court and defend themselves as best they can.
Against unjust evictions?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We had some pro per defendants. We hit three demure victories in the last couple of weeks.
You don't mean demure like real polite, but demure victories.
Demure like is the first line of defense for any defendants in any legal action.
And a demur actually was simply a statement that the original charge is badly formed,
yes.
Right, or inappropriate for some reason.
Mm-hmm. And so therefore, demur.
So what did this mean in terms of substance? You said that, so in other words, the landlords are coming to court with a...
more resistance.
What's that? They're
meeting a lot more resistance now
so
than they have before.
So when they came into court, they had their legal duckies were not all lined up too well, and so you pointed that out, and that killed the case in the beginning.
Detainer, this is nothing.
And you didn't do this with a lawyer, you did this without a lawyer, right?
Well, with law books and forms and under some guidance of legal advice, yes.
How difficult is it for the average person? How many hours would you say a person has to spend in the law library to get a grip on her or his case in a landlord tenant?
Like coming right out of the cold, 8 hours.
8 hours. So it does take a certain commitment of time.
Mm-hmm. especially if you like a moderate kind of academic sort of person, because what it is reading, writing, comprehension.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you have to be up there with that.
But you, on the other hand, having gone through this process yourself numerous times, can kind of short-circuit it for people so they can actually get some of the essentials more quickly?
It is real grueling stuff. You know, and the unlawful detainer process goes at a breakneck speed. It kind of abridges the due process. All the other civil cases, they get, you know, 30 days to respond. With the unlawful detainer, it's 5 days. And the unlawful detainer cases, if you notice in court, they take precedence over criminal cases and everything else.
So while civil cases sit on the back burner for months, if not years, unlawful detainer cases are more important than rape or murder to our court system.
Just about, yes.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. And that is why there's, you know, they make the laws, they have all the money, they have their professional agencies, and that's where we advocate a banding together of people. You know, everybody throws in their $2 worth, but there's 100,000 renters in Santa Cruz County. You know, that we could generate, you know, at $2 a month each. That's quite a bundle of money that, for an organization that could lobby and work and defend and have like all kinds of legal expertise at their hands.
And you, in fact, and Donna, and I guess others working with your group, have been making that expertise available essentially on a shoestring, and you really need folks to kind of kick in a little, a dollar or two a month to, you know, help support that effort so you can actually, I guess you're printing a publication now as well?
Right, we have a Know Your Rights handbill, which has reprints from Nolo Press, and thanks to Nolo Press for their contribution of like 16 books to our library. Since renters don't really have too many rights, you know, you can fit them on two pages of paper.
Yeah, right.
So we're able to make a handbill out of it, but they're all there. And so it's like immediately, we're making hundreds of these. You know, our budget is low, so we have to get money in as we print out with that kind of a shoestring, out of the pocket, seat of the pants organization, yet still. Although we are asking for money from the city of Capitola, the city of Santa Cruz, and the county.
Now, if folks want to contact you, I guess they can call your number at, I guess it's 426-0644?
Yes, it is indeed.
426-0644 for the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay, I think that's about it for now. But we have, there's two things coming up. At the board, one at the Board of Supervisors.
I didn't mean to cut you off. You please take as much time as you need to speak.
No, Donna's getting me a message at the same time.
Oh. Okay.
There is a mobile park home out in Watsonville, and I guess day laborers live there, and et cetera. And there's long-term residents have been there also, and they're being removed by the county, so there's going to be a demonstration at the city council.
And when is that?
Tuesday after next.
Are we talking about Santa Cruz City Council or Watsonville?
County Board of Supervisors.
So at the Board of Supervisors, and again, what time will that be?
Be in the morning. Be an all-day thing. There'll be a demonstration outside also.
So in other words, at the county building at 701 Ocean Street on Tuesday, a week from, it's not this coming Tuesday, but
yes.
It is this coming Tuesday?
No, a week from.
A week from this Tuesday. And so I guess
the 28th.
It'll be the 28th of April, and I guess it starts around 9 o'clock in the morning?
Yes.
That's on the supervisors meet on the fifth floor of the county building, but you can also, I guess, talk to folks who will be flyering in front?
Yes, there'll be an all-day demonstration.
And if folks want to help with this demonstration, can they call you?
They can call us here at 426-0644.
And where do they send their money to if they want to actually make sure that you're still around by that time and haven't been evicted?
Oh, for the Tenants' Rights Union, donations and enrollment fees can be sent to P.O. Box 7484 Santa Cruz 95061.
Post Office Box 7484 Santa Cruz
95061.
And of course, if you haven't gotten that number, just give a call to the Tenants' Rights Union Santa Cruz phone number.
And soon we hope to be getting our place on Water Street. We have a battle for it now.
This, of course, will be a storefront opening right across from the court.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right near the jail.
Right.
So if you get evicted, you can go straight to jail afterward if you like.
Yeah. And this week we had a big victory in the clerk's office.
Uh-huh. Okay.
See, when a defendant places a demur, by law, it's 20 days.
Again, a demur, clarifying for the audience, is a statement that the charges against you are improperly filed. So even before you put in a plea of guilty or not guilty or contest it further in a criminal case or even take it further in a civil case,
you get a demur hearing, and it's set for 20 days.
You get a delay. So instead of a 5-day leeway, you get a 20-day leeway, right?
You're right. And then you go to a hearing, which will go over with the judge, the grounds for the demur, etc. And then from there, if you win or lose, you continue from that point on. But what happened with one of our members, so they went down and tried to get the, went for the 20-day demur, okay, 20-day notice for the demur, setting it for 20 days in advance on the calendar. The court clerk put up a big fight about it because it was unlawful detainer, and they wanted to set it for 7 days. And this, being that it's an unlawful detainer, doesn't matter because there is nothing that goes beyond the rules of court 315. That's what which regulates the amount of time for service on the
court. Why would the clerk be so concerned about speeding up the process and short-circuiting the law here? What's going on?
Because there is a mentality within the court system throughout the state that when tenants start to demur, and there's been a fivefold increase in demurs or more in the last 2 months or so, they want to shorten that time because real property is involved. Real property is more sacred than anything, you know. By just looking at the speed and the abridgment of the due process of the unlawful detainer laws. So that's the subtext to why they wanted to limit it to 7 days, but they can't do that.
Uh-huh.
And they kept on insisting that that's what they were going to do, and we had to keep on, Paul had to keep on reciting the law to them and demanding to go above whoever it was that was presenting the obstacle. He wanted to see the judge's order in writing, et cetera. He wanted to see the policy in writing, and they couldn't present any of that. So they finally had to go back and give him the 20 days. But that's the kind of fight that we're putting up here.
So you need to be, I guess the lesson here is you need to be informed, persistent, have some people with you to be supportive,
yes,
and just keep repeating your right, and if they deny it to you, then ask to go to the next higher level. You know, I also recall we've been talking about the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz's efforts to get a more legitimate, profound, basic Bill of Rights for tenants here in the Santa Cruz County, both through the supervisors, through this